Thanks a lot for Takuya for inviting me to speak here, and thank you for the opportunity. So I will be, as Takuya said, this will be a series of three lectures on the subject of integrability in planar ADS-CFT. I will assume people know nothing about the subject, so I will start from scratch on lecture one and try to move on until our latest results, which I will cover on Tuesday. So ADS-CFT relating a four-dimensional conformal field theory, four-dimensional gauge theory, which is the conformal field theory, and thought to be strings on ADS-5 cross S5, was discovered a couple of years ago to be integrable in the planar limits. So there is by now hope that we might be able, in this planar limit, to compute the exact spectra of these theories. What I will be speaking about is about the computation of the spectra of both the string theory dual, which is thought to be strings on ADS-5, and of n equals 4 super young nils, which is, of course, a very relevant problem. I don't think I will need to motivate it. So let me start. I will start by some very basic stuff today about what is the dilatation operator in the planar limit, why can it be associated, where does integrability appear, this spin chain story. I will compute the one-loop dilatation operator. I will explain what is Bittan-Zott, what's the physics behind Bittan-Zott, what integrability means. And then I will consider at the end the toy model, which is a condensed matter problem of understanding how to put an Heisenberg spin chain at finite temperature and how to compute the free energy of this model. It's a toy model. Technically, many of the features we will see here will be important for the third lecture. So by the end of today, I would have explained how to compute the spectra to one loop of some operators in the so-called SU2 sector. And then tomorrow on Monday, I would like to generalize what we will see today, one loop of SU2 operators to all loops, all kind of operators of n equals 4, to all orders. And this will be an asymptotic result in a sense that I will explain. It will be the exact spectrum for large enough operators. And then on the third lecture, I will explain how to overcome the limitation of large operators and how to compute really the exact spectra of the theory. So please stop me at any point with any questions you might have. So let me remind you about the connection between renormalization and anomalous dimensions. So we consider, let's consider a simple CFT just with one field and some coupling G square. So we have some field phi of x, and we have some other field at some other point 0, 1, we compute the correlation function of this simple CFT. So what do we get? Well, first we get the classical dimension of the field when we just do the with the free theory. And then there is a coupling G. So when we do perturbation theory, what we typically get is we get something proportional to G squared when we consider the one loop result. And then when we consider the loop, there will be a divergence, which will be something like log x squared lambda squared. On dimensional ground, this is the only thing I can get. This is what I get when I consider, when I pick this correlation function and make the one loop, when I compute this quantity here to one loop. So what does it mean? It means that if I consider the operator phi renormalized, which will be equal to exponential of gamma g squared log of the cutoff times my original field, phi of x, let's put a subscript 0 to indicate that the fields are bare. Then this operator, phi renormalized of x, phi renormalized at 0, this new operator, they will behave as 1 over x to the 2 delta, where delta is the classical dimension, plus an anomalous part. So this makes perfect sense. So I'm renormalizing my operator, my phi naught, it has a bare dimension. Now, of course, since I multiplied by this factor, lambda, and here I have log of lambda,
It's a dimension for quantity.
Yes, I can put some regulator if I want. But what I want to say is that, you see, this operator, as you say, it's dimension full. It has a dimension. It's this, I can write this as lambda to the g squared gamma times phi naught of x. So as you said, it's a dimensional full quantity. But this makes sense. The operator has a dimension. The dimension is no longer the classical dimension. The dimension of this operator changed. It was renormalized. So we see that when we consider, when we construct these operators, which now have finite correlation functions, we renormalize them so that the correlation functions are finite, and automatically we get the anomalous dimensions. So now let's consider a more complicated CFT. So now we consider n equals 4. So what is n equals 4? Let me write a Lagrangian here. So Lagrangian, we have something like, let me see how I chose to renormalize this. Then my fields of n equals 4, there is a trace, so the fields are n by n matrices. There is a covariance derivative, phi I. There are some scalars. There is an interaction, a four-point interaction of the scalars. There are some fermions. There are ghosts. And there is gauge fixing, which I'm not writing down, I will not name. So this is the Lagrangian of n equals 4. There's a minus. So this curly derivative is contracted with a 10-dimensional gamma matrices, and here there is the gauge field and the scalars. This I runs from 1 to 6, so there are 6 scalars. And mu runs from 0 to 4, to 3. So now, in my more complicated CFT, the operators I consider now, instead of phi naught of x, now I will consider some operator with a general index I. Let's consider for now operators of the form phi I1, phi IL. So this I here stands for all these indices I1 up to IL. And now again, if I compute now correlation functions of these operators, O I of x times O j of 0, I will get 1 over x to the 2 delta naught, where delta naught will be equal to L. And then again, I get the three weak contractions. And then, in general, I get minus a divergence. Again, it must be lambda squared x squared. Let me put the g squared here. So let me write g squared. It will be g and mu squared times n, just for normalization, so 16 pi squared. But now, for each operator with some indices I and j, I will have a different operator ij. It will differ differently. So what this means is that if I want to renormalize, if I want to check which operator that the good anomalous dimensions, the, what are the operators which scale in this way, I should diagonalize this h. So my operators renormalized with some index I are now exponential of this operator h times lambda ij times my operator, my bare operators j. So this h, its eigenvalues are the anomalous dimensions, the set of deltas, and its eigenvectors, which are basically psi I1 up to IL times trace of O I1, O, not O, phi, phi I1, phi IL. This is an operator. They have some wave function, some linear combination of the original operators. This will be my, if it is an eigenvector, this will be my operator with the anomalous dimension delta.
Call this gamma.
Sorry?
Call the anomalous dimension gamma.
Sorry, the total dimension. Yeah, so this is, how did I call it? Gamma. So delta delta. So delta delta is equal to this gamma g squared. Yeah? So, okay, so if I compute this anomalous dimension, this, if I renormalize with this Hamiltonian H, I obtain the spectra of anomalous dimension and I obtain which are the operators with the good anomalous dimensions, which are the good operators of my conformal field theory. So I would like to show explicitly how it goes, because it's a simple computation and it's a nice one, how it goes for these operators of this form. So for this, SOC operators. So I pick my operator, and here we will see that the planar limit will appear. So I represent my operator, a trace of fields, in this notation. So this line means that the index of SUN is the same. So this will be my operator OI of X. I did not renormalize it yet. And next, I will consider some probes here. This will be some fields, some probes. And I want the correlation function with these probes. So I want these probes here with my operator renormalized to be finite. I want to renormalize them. So I want correlation functions to be finite. Now, so what are the graphs which appear at one loop? So here I will have something, some interaction. So what is this interaction at one loop? What are the graphs which I have at one loop? So now I will forget about, so let me stress that you see already that I can put some probes here, some operators here, and consider the divergences. And because I'm working strictly in the planar limits, I only need to consider this type of interactions between the nearest neighbors. I don't need to consider interaction where this leg interacts with this one, because it would have to cross some other legs. It would be non-planar. So I only need to consider this planar interaction. So my operator, the divergence, they will mix fields which are nearest neighbors. So it will tell me that this trace of phi I1 up to phi IL may mix with another trace which is very similar to this one. It only differs by some two fields being eventually exchanged. So what is this, what is this diagram? So this diagram, there is a divergence when I exchange a gluon between the two scalars coming from the covariant derivative there. There is a term where here I'm representing only the index I. This means that the index I is not exchanged. This comes from this commutator square. There is a term where the two fields, they are annihilated and created again, also from the commutator, and also from the commutator, there is a term where the indexes I and j are exchanged. This is, of course, the planar graph. This I mean that the index I is exchanged. It's planar. So this would be D1, and this would be the diagram 4. So let's just compute D1.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
Is this the line of the specific gauge?
Yeah, exactly. So this, if I compute in a different gauge, for example, this result will be gauge dependent. But then there are also the self-energy contributions, and the gauge dependence drops out. So this result is dependent. In general, when I compute this Hamiltonian here, it is in general dependent on two things, gauge and the renormalization scheme. But the eigenvalues must not be. It will turn out that for our case, even the gauge drops off. But in the most general case, for example, when the Hamiltonian is computed, say, to 4 loops or 3 loops, people know that there are some terms in the Hamiltonian which do depend on the gauge or on the renormalization scheme. But the anomalous dimensions, once you diagonalize it, they are independent. They are physical quantities.
In other gauges, can there be one diagonal of the two scalars become two gauges?
No. This I cannot. I cannot. You are saying, you are staying from this one, here.
I don't
know. No, they...
Two scalars to two gluons. The gluons have to end on the scalar.
And I'm putting them planned on the scale. Yeah, it's. So you are. On two gluons. So, those diagrams cancel, I think. But I've got to.
I think I'll cancel this specific gauge of
field. Let's take that. I didn't think a lot about this. Except from this data, maybe. I think they don't appear. I know that they don't appear. I will try to think and reply. So I have my indices here, my index I, say, let's say IN, and here IN plus 1, and here the index JN and JN plus 1. So this diagram doesn't change color, so it's delta IN JN, delta IN plus 1, JN plus 1. And then what is this divergence? I put there, let me have some momenta Q going here. Let me insert some momenta P, some momenta K. This is just to be sure that I have no infrared divergences. Yeah. And then what do I have? So I have three propagators from these three lines. So I get 1 over G and Niels. No, I have this properly. I have.
Could you do the same diagram with the fat lines? Because there you just use one.
This one? Okay. This diagram with fat lines, it would be.
You just mean that you put the. You make it fat.
Okay. Yeah, I just make them fat. So there are two vertices. So I have 1 over gm mil squared. Then there are three propagators. So I have gm mil. I have gm mil squared over 2 cubed, three vertices. Then I have a loop here. As you said, there is this n here. So there is an n here. And then there is an integral over this virtual momenta over 2 pi to the 4. And then there are the propagators. So there is q squared. Q minus y squared and q minus p squared, and then there is this vertex with the derivative, so I get a factor. If I do this, I get minus 4, 2 p minus q dot q minus 2 k. So this is what I get for this contribution, and this seems already quite complicated to compute, but recall that we only want the log lambda divergence. So if I only want the log lambda divergence, I can expand this at large q. It comes from the large q. So all this term here, as you see, there is minus 4. This behaves as minus 4 over q squared. And I can drop all the q's and p's were there. This term here, so this part is 2 pi cubed q cubed d cubed. So you see there is, sorry, q squared, no, q squared squared. So q cubed against the q to the 4 gives 1 over q, so it gives a log. And if I keep track of all factors, this gives me 16 pi squared n g m mil squared. No, 16 pi squared is downstairs. 16 pi squared times log of the kettle. Probably not everyone can read this. I will repeat. This is equal to n g m mil squared over 16 pi squared log lambda. And according to the definition which I wrote there for g squared, I wrote somewhere at the very end, this is just g squared log of the kettle.
So what is lambda? Is it which kettle?
The cutoff here, upper cutoff. I will put a cutoff in a moment.
And but you also put the infrared cutoff?
And it is infrared finite, because of this Q, this moment which I inside. So my computer, I just got that V1 was G squared log lambda, and then there were these two indices which were equal. So I represented it like this. So the two indices, they were not exchanged. The two indices were conserved by the glue and doesn't carry any copy. Then if I compute the other graphs, I just wanted to show you how it goes. It is quite simple. So for D2, I get 2 g squared log lambda. So now I change the notation. So this is D4. I will exchange the order here. This is the guy which exchanges the indices. Then I have another D, which is minus g squared log lambda, the one with the trace, which is D3, and then I have the remaining one, D2, which is G squared log lambda. Actually, 2 G squared log lambda. No, this one is already there. So, this G squared log lambda, the one which preserves the indices. So these are all the contributions that I get from all diagrams. I get this 4. And then there is self-energy for the legs, and the self-energy, they are also of this form, because it's for each leg times something times log lambda. I don't remember exactly, but I will tell you that the sum of all these terms, I get minus g squared log lambda times twice this term, which keeps the indices, plus this term, minus twice the one missing. So these are the total divergences. If I compute all the divergences at one loop, I get the divergence proportional to log lambda. There is a g square, and then there is this structure here. So what does it mean in terms of this Hamiltonian which I want to compute? It means that my Hamiltonian
H will be of the form, there will be a G square, sum over the sides of the spin chain, I equal 1 up to L. You need not think of spin chain yet. And then some Hamiltonian, which interacts only between nearest neighbors because of what I said, we are in a planar limit, where this HI, I plus 1, is what I drew here, which is equal to twice the identity plus the trace operator minus twice the permutation operator, whereby each operator is clear from the picture what I mean.
Patrick?
Yeah?
Can I ask a really dumb question? But
sure.
In that diagram, why there are only three propagators rather than five? Say, for example, in D1.
No, these ones are belong to the other guys. I only need to consider those ones.
Oh, I see. You only take
the three are for this one. Oh, like,
thanks.
So, here then it becomes quite convenient to look at these operators, O, as being some spin chain states on which this operator acts. So now I will move to this language of spin chain. So I will think of my operator that I wrote there, O delta. I will think of this operator now as some wave function, which depends on the positions, I1 up to IL, it's my psi which I wrote there, times some spin chain state, I1 up to IL. And on two neighbors, the identity acting on each I1 runs from 1 to 6, each, of course, for the other ones the same. So the identity acting on two neighboring seeds, AB, gives just AB. The permutation acting on two neighboring spins, AB, permutes the two spins, gives me BA. And the trace operator acting on two spins, AB, gives me 0 unless they are equal, and when they are equal, it creates me all the other spins. So I have a sum from 1 to 6 of the other ones. So here the identity between seed size detects on I and I plus 1, I plus 1, I and I plus 1. So any questions so far? So far, the only thing we did was we computed the dilatation operator of n equals 4. And we interpreted it as being a spin chain Hamiltonian, which acts on some spin chain. So, but this was just a question of notation. We had some trace, and we said, now I look at the trace as being some spin chain operator. So this is only a question of notation. So far, integrability didn't appear yet. This was just a way of looking at this operator. So if I now diagonalize, if I find which operators, what in the spectrum of this operator, I get at once the eigenvectors, which are the operators with a good dimension, and the eigenvalues, which are the anomalous dimensions of my theory. Now, what was remarkable, and all this was done by Minahan and Zarembo, what is remarkable is that the ratio of these two coefficients, this ratio, which is equal to minus 2, is precisely the ratio which ensures that the theory is integrable. Integrability. So precisely this ratio here, if these coefficients were different, the model would not be integrable. So what is remarkable is that these coefficients turn out to be precisely those, so that the Hamiltonian is integrable, and we can compute its spectrum exactly by means of some integrability techniques known as Bittan-Zaks, which I will describe later. So this was quite unexpected, that we would compute and it would be precisely the one which is integrable. And later, when people computed not only this SO6 sector, but when they computed the spectrum of all operators, again, it was shown to be integrable. When they went on to more loops, it was again seen to be integrable. And more recently, in this new ABS-CFT duality between ABS-4 and CFT-3, this new ABJM theory, again, people computed and people believe that there exists integrability to all loops there. So before I explain what is the physics behind integrability and why some models are integrable and not, let me just remind you. So we computed the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is some G squared times some nearest neighbors interactions. Let me draw it symbolically like this. And of course, if we were to compute it to higher orders, we will start having next to nearest neighbors and then next to nearest neighbors interactions, etc. And the order of the interaction will be longer and longer. Here it's only nearest neighbors and then it will be a longer and longer range of Hamiltonian. So, any questions? So, as I told in the plan, today I will focus only on a particular sector of the theory, which is the so-called SU2 sector. So this is a very important subsector of the theory. And the SU2 sector consists of the fields of the form trace, some fields Z, then some scalars X, where Z is a scalar combination, it's a complex combination of these scalars, with phi 1 plus I phi 2, and X is phi 3 plus I phi 4. So this is a closed subsector of the theory, and it consists of quantum truncation to consider only operators of this form. They will only mix among themselves. Actually, this is true even to all others, not only that one. So what is the Hamiltonian? One more thing. So these operators, so we make it to here, this operator to an SO6 spin chain. This is okay, it's a possible spin chain, SO6. These ones, they map to the usual spin chain, to the usual Heisenberg spin chain. I can think as this Z as being spin up, and then I have an X which is a spin down. Then I have my spin up, my spin down, my spin up. So here it's really a usual map between SU2 operators and XXX spin chains, really usual spin chains with SU2 spins. And what is the Hamiltonian here when I make this restriction? So you see that the Hamiltonian, so there is a G square, there is a sum when I runs from 1 up to L, and then there is identity, trace, and permutation. The trace gives zero when acting on those operators, right? It gives zero because when it acts on some z which is neighbor to an x, there is no index which is the same, 1, 3, 1, 4, 2, 3, and 2, 4, so it's always zero. And it also gives zero, k, when it acts on two z's, because this is k acting on phi 1, phi 1, minus k acting on phi 2, phi 2, because of the I. And also these terms give the same, both of these terms is this sum. So k of acting, and of course k acting on zx is obviously zero. So the trace doesn't enter when I consider this subsector. I get a 2 because the other two terms have a 2. And then I get the usual Heisenberg Hamiltonian, just identity minus the permutation. Okay. And this Hamiltonian is an integral Hamiltonian, and I will discuss in a second how to compute the exact spectrum of this Hamiltonian. But now let me then mention what is integrability. And I will now integrate it first. So integrability usually means when I say I have some integrable model, normally what people have in mind is I have some model which I can solve. So this, of course, is the most basic answer. Integrability stands for something which I can solve. Mathematically, normally what one means by integrable model, when I have some classical integrable model, normally it means a model where I can separate the action and angle variables, and I have a precise notion of some angle variables and I can solve it completely. Quantum integrability is much harder to define because in some sense all models are integrable. Quantum integrability, the way I will define it, will be by factorized scattering. So I will say that the theory is integrable if the scattering of three body particles factorizes into two body particles scattering. So how does this go? So in 1 plus 1 dimensions, which is where integrable theories live, and this will also become clear. So in 1 plus 1 dimension, when I pick two momenta, P1 and P2, and I scatter these two particles, and they go into P1 prime and P2 prime, some elastic scattering, this is, of course, equal to the same set of momenta, P1 and P2. And this is simply because there exists a conserved charge, which is called momenta, which is sum of momenta, and there is some Q2, some conserved charge Q2, which is sum of momenta squared, say. Or in a lattice, sum of sine square of P over 2. So I have some two conserved charges, and because energy and momenta is conserved at the same time, the final momentum must be a permutation of the original momentum. Nothing else can change. Nothing else can happen. Now, When I now scatter three particles, when I have some three particles scattering, P1, P2, and P3, and I scatter it, and I get P1 prime, P2 prime, and P3 prime, in general, this is not the same as the original set, P1, P2, and P3. Because I have two conservation charges, so in general, I only impose that the total energy and total momentum is conserved. But this, they will be equal if there exists another charge, a fancy charge, something like Q2, which would be something like sum over Pj cubed. Not only Pj, but Pj squared. But imagine there is some extra charge in the theory, like sum of Pq. And imagine this charge is also conserved. So when such charge exists, then the set of momenta, the set of original and final momenta, is the same. So what does it physically mean? It means that I pick three particles, I scatter it, and I obtain the same three momenta. So I will say, in the bulk, where they scattered in a pairwise manner, because otherwise, how come I would have only a permutation of the original momenta? The way for it to happen in the bulk is because the interactions were only pairwise, and every time there was an interaction, the momenta simply exchanged. There is a nicer way to see this. Consider a process where I prepare three wave packets, and I prepare them in such a way that they will scatter at the same point. And now I can apply a conserved charge to this process. I can apply Q1, Q2, or Q3. If I apply the conserved charge Q1, it just means that the amplitude for this process to happen here or to happen there, a couple of meters, it's the same. It's the same probability. So this is just translation invariance. If I apply the charge Q2, it just means that I can do the experiments here or tomorrow, time translation. What happens if I apply to a wave packet the charge Q3? And this is easily seen. You can construct a wave packet in Fourier and apply this charge Q3, which is just means that you multiply by PQ. And what it happens is that it also shifts the charges, but it shifts the charges by a quantity which depends on the momentum of the particle. And therefore, what I get is something like this. The lines are shifted, but they depend on each momentum. And therefore, if I apply this Q3, I get that the scattering matrix from of 3 to 3 is given by a product of the scattering matrices of 2 to 2. This is precisely what our intuition was telling us before, that these conserved charges were implying that the scattering was factorized. More than that, I can apply the transformation with in one direction or in the other, so I would also obtain that this process is equal to the same process where the chronological order of the scattering is different. So, higher conserved charges, they imply two things. They apply, on the one hand, factorizability. So they imply factorized scattering. And they also imply Young-Baxter relation. Young-Baxter relation is a relation of this one. SSS is equal to SSS. I'm not putting the indices, I think it's obvious, right? SP1 with P2, SP2 with P3. I get this triangular relation. So factorized scattering and Young-Baxter relation is what I will mean by quantum integrability. So notice that this Young-Baxter relation, it might seem a triviality, but normally these S's, they are matrices. Normally particles, they have some colors and they might exchange when they scatter. So this is an untrivial identity on the S matrix. So normally this is something quite constraining on what kind of S matrix I might have. And then I have this factorized scattering here. Notice also that, just for fun, that in D greater than 2, if I consider some higher dimension like the ones we live on, if I scatter three particles and I prepare the three-wave packets, imagine I add some charge Q3, then what would happen is that I would shift the particles by a quantity which will depend on the momenta, but now in general they would no longer meet. The scattering would become very separate, this would be some three-dimensional space. And therefore, the S matrix will be just one. And this is Coleman and Lugo, right? So if I have higher charges in three dimensions, the theory is trivial.
You haven't assumed anything about relativistic invariant.
Sorry?
You haven't assumed relativistic invariant, right?
No, here no. Here I'm considering some non-relativistic stuff. But this is the general argument. Higher charges, they move the lines, they move with packets. in a quantity which depends on momenta, particles no longer scatter, the theory is true. In two dimensions, no. In two dimensions, you can delay, but they will always have to scatter. They will just scatter one, and then 1 year after, the other one will scatter, and 1 year after, the other one will scatter. So then, we can consider now some integrable model, some integrable theory, on a large circle. So I have a large circle and some particles on this large circle. And this circle can be a lattice, or it can be continuum like that. The argument which I gave for the continuum, it would hold similarly for the lattice, with some t squared becoming some psi squared. And now I have some lattice, and I have some momenta pj, and then I have the other momenta, the other pk. And I have some particle with some momenta going on in this circle. Large circle of length L. So I have my circle of length L, and I have my several particles. I have my particle 1 up to the particle n. Now, if the theory is integrable, and if the circle is big, I can very easily understand how the quantization of this momenta goes. I say the following. Let me pick the multiparticle wave function, and I will do this rigorously for the spin chain, but let's just do it in general for fun. I pick the wave function, and I impose that when I carry one particle around the range, the wave function is periodic. So I get that when I pick one particle and carry it around the ring, I get the free propagation, exponential of the momenta times L. This is just a free propagation. And then it will scatter with the other particles. But we know that the scattering factorizes. So the scattering with the other particles I can write as a product over k not equal to j up to n, some S matrix, which will be the two body S matrix, pj and pk, and this must be equal to 1. So this is, these are what are called the Bittern-Zach equations. So,
the definition of n equal to 4 being integrable is not there in 3 plus 1 dimension.
So n equals 4, the 1 plus 1 dimension is the spin chain. So n equals 4 is the integral in the sense, I will explain, the sense that this one dimensional object, this x here, which move in this chain, they scatter in a factorized way. So it's integrable, the one dimension appears in n equals 4 as a spin chain, and it appears in the dual model as a string, and as the excitation in the string of the dual gravitational model. All right? So there is, in both theories, this one-dimensional object. In one case, the single trace operator, in the other case, the single strings. So you are right, it's integrable in a non-trivial way. It's not that I have a four-dimensional theory, the scattering of n equals 4, it's non-trivial, but there is this. For the spectrum, there is this nice integrability entering the game. That's how we define it. Once I quantize this momenta, the energy, the spectrum, is given by some sum over the number of particles of some dispersion relation of the particles. So this is the next to most trivial case after the free particle. After the free particle, if the exponential of momenta times L is equal to 1, here I have some extra product of S matrix. I quantize my momenta in a circle, and then I sum over the momenta. Now, unless the interactions are ultra-local, unless they are like some delta function or some contact interactions, the Bittern-Zach equations are asymptotic. They are not exact, because they assume this circle to be large. I need a large circle, I need this notion of having enough space to have the wave packets running and then scattering, to have the plane waves running and then scattering. I need the circle to be big. I need to have some regions where the particles are well separated, where I can read the energy. So normally there are corrections, which are some exponential of ML. In the case of n equals 4, we will see that they will be of the order g squared to the 12, because it will be an order where the interaction range of the Hamiltonian starts wrapping around the cylinder, as I told. So normally the Bittern-Zach is asymptotic. However, for the case which I will describe now, it will be exact precisely because the interaction is ultra-local. It only interacts between next and nearest neighbors. So, any questions so far? So let me explain then how the computation goes. So now we are back to n=4.
Andrew?
Yes?
So you gave an argument basically saying that there is not non-trivial solution to the Young-Baxter equation in higher than two dimensions over there. So I just wonder, so what if you have, say, massless particles in the theory?
Sorry? If you have?
If you have, say, massless particles in the theory such that even if the wave packets don't quite overlap, there may still be some non-trivial interactions between them.
Yes, okay, I understand. So what you're asking is, if the theory is massless, then it might be that I'm separating them, but they are never really separated because the theory is, say, conformal or something. So this feature does not necessarily imply that S is one because there are some subtleties related to the particles being massless, right?
That is exactly what.
So, and this might be the case in n=4 superhidden fields from the target space point of view, from the space-time point of view. Because there, indeed, there seems to exist some extra symmetry other than usual, this dual conformal symmetry, for example, and still the S matrix is non-trivial. So there it seems to exist a bit more than what you would allow it to exist, a bit more symmetry. Not a lot more, but a bit more. And still, S matrix is not one. But in general...
On the other hand, there is no reason to expect the n=4 theory in the target space to say, satisfy the Young-Baxter equation.
No, it will not satisfy Young-Baxter equation, no. Okay, so now back to n=4. And let's consider then these operators where I have some spins. And now we consider our particle. So this will be a particle, also known as magnon. In this language, the spins and particles are normally called magnon. So I have all the spins are up, one spin is down at position n. This state I baptize as n, and normally what we do is I go to Fourier, so I sum from n=1 up to the size of the chain, and I give it some momenta to this excitation. And recall that the moment, the Hamiltonian was g² sum of identity minus permutation. So if we act now, so let's call this state p, please. Okay, this notation might be not the most ingenious one. So I have P here, and then here I use the same notation, but of course when I use letters which resemble momenta, I don't mean the same when I use letters M and M for this kind of stuff, and P and Q for this kind of stuff. Okay? There's no confusion, right? So when I act on my Hamiltonian on my momenta, you see what I get. I get g², and then identity minus permutator, when it acts here, it's always zero, because to do nothing or to permute, it's the same. It only does something when it acts here and here. So the Hamiltonian gives something non-trivial only on it on when it acts on these two non-trivial sides. So then it's easy to see that I get, when I act on one of these guys, I get this. When I act on the other side, this is from one side, and this is from one of the non-trivial connections, and the other one from the other two non-trivial neighbors, times exactly the same state P. And this is equal to 4g² sine square of p over 2 times the state p. So this is what I call epsilon of p. So this is the energy of a single magnet. It's the analog of p², it's just that I'm in a lattice, and therefore I get sine squared. So now we can move on and consider two particles. So when I consider two particles, what do I have? Now I have my state, say, which will be some, I will have my spin chain. So let me construct a wave function. I sum over n and m. Let n be smaller than m. Then I have some wave function. And then I have n and m. So all spins are up. And it's down at position n and m. OK. Now, and this is my state. So, yes?
Sorry, this is really stupid, but there is this permutation. I mean,
this? Okay.
In the case of single particle.
Good point. So there is, normally the trace is cyclic, so normally I should impose zero momenta for my states. I should consider not only the Eisenberg spin chain, but since all my states should be cyclic because of the trace, I should consider a truncation of the states. I should only consider the states which are mapped to n equals 4 are only those which have total zero momenta. So this would not be a state of n equals 4, because you are right that I could cyclically change it and I will get the this sum times this state and this sum is zero, unless p is zero.
Right.
But I'm considering here the XXX spin chain, not considering the fact that I should consider zero momentum for my states, because I want to introduce this notion of particle, two particles, three particles, without having to worry about it.
So
in n equals 4, sorry?
So I can just say, I can in fact be, so you want me to forget about the trace. But
yes, I consider only now this spin chain. Oh. So it's not exactly n equals 4, it's really not the XXX spin chain. Which contains, in some sense, the n equals 4 as we could see. Okay. So now I should start theorizing. So now I consider this state with some wave function psi n and m times some energy. And let me just show you. Do you see the eraser? Okay. And now I act on the Hamiltonian on this state and impose that I get again the same state times the energy of the state. So when I impose that the Hamiltonian times psi is equal to energy times psi, right, I act on the Hamiltonian on this state and I want to get the same state. In terms of the wave function, I get the following. I get energy times the wave function in position n and m. And this line will be for m bigger than m plus 1. So they are well separated. Energy times this psi must be equal, this is this side here of the equation, I'm sorry, must be equal to the action of the Hamiltonian. So how can I come to this wave function? So now, the Hamiltonian is non-zero only when it acts here, here, or here, or here, right? And I go to this configuration, n and m, four times when I am already at position n and m, and I act with the identity, which doesn't change. And then I can come to this configuration when acting with the permutator on the state n and m plus or minus 1, minus when I act on the state m plus minus 1 plus n. So there is a sum, there are five terms there. Right? So when I have, so this wave function arrives here when I get through the permutator or through the identity. And then I have an extra equation, energy, when they are close, n plus 1. So when they are like this, but when they are like this, they are also killed. Now, this also kills. The Hamiltonian here also gives zero. So now I get only two contributions from the side n and n plus 1, which is these two contributions of the identity when it acts there, minus a contribution, which was n minus 1, n plus 1, when this one jumps from there to there, minus psi of n, n plus 2. So I get these two conditions which I must solve for my wave. So what I do now is I will propose an ansatz, and this is what's called the beta ansatz, for my wave function. And my ansatz will be that my wave function, psi n and m, will be exponential of I kn plus I pn. I have two parts of the momenta p and n. But this is not a good solution. If I plug this solution and act with the Hamiltonian, this does not give me a good eigenvector. I need plus one term, let me parameterize it, 1 over s of k and p, times an exponential where the momenta are exchanged, which is like the reflection, pi n plus I k m. So this is like the incoming wave, and this is like the reflected wave. And now, I have these two equations to satisfy. If I plug now this and that into the first equation, A, it's just the Laplace equation acting on each of these guys, here and here. Both separately, they are okay for the first one, because the first one is just free propagation. It doesn't care whether there are two particles or not. So from A, I just get that the energy is epsilon of t plus epsilon of k. Doesn't constrain at all my S matrix. Both terms would be okay if it was only A, which I would have to solve. Where epsilon is again exactly the same as before. Epsilon given there. And then I can use B. Let me do a clever trick. Notice that this and that holds for A when m is bigger than n plus 1, but also when m is equal to n plus 1. Because this and that is just free propagation. This term gives just a free propagation. So this and that here is also trivially satisfies this one, even when m is n plus 1, because it's just free propagation. So if I compute A when m is n plus 1 minus B, what do I get? These terms energy cancel. Here I get 2 psi of n, n plus 1, and then I get n, n minus psi, n minus 1, n minus 1. This is what I get. This must be equal to 0, and this constrains my S matrix. This will fix my S matrix completely. So this will imply that my S matrix of K and B will be equal, it will fix me to be 1 half of cotangent of k over 2 minus 1 half of cotangent of p over 2 minus I over the same thing with plus I. 1 half cotangent p over 2 minus 1 half cotangent of p over 2, sorry, the first one is k, plus I. So this gives me what is my 2 by 2 S matrix.
In order to define the Bayes' Ansatz equation as a momentum conservation condition, right? So it is.
Precisely, that's what I'm going now to do. Now I'm going to find this equation. So far, I found the S matrix. S matrix is something which does not depend on the particles being on a circle, actually. So the S matrix I found from the scattering of the particles when they were close. Now I will input periodicity of the wave function. So now, indeed, I impose what I already said. I said that now I impose that my wave function is periodic. There is a small subtlety. I should do it like this. I should exchange the two indices because I impose that the first argument is smaller than the second one. And then I impose it here. So I shift this term here by L. So I get from the first exponential of I k times L must be equal to the second term when m and n is exchanged. But if m and n are exchanged, I now go to the second exponential. So it should be equal to this 1 over s. I put it in the same side, and therefore I get s of kp is equal to 1. So these are precisely the Bayes' Ansatz equations I spoke before in a more general form. So at the free propagation plus the s matrix is equal to 1. So this quantizes me my momenta, and then I compute the energy by summing epsilon of p and epsilon of k. And I have a similar equation for p. E to the I P L times S of P and K is equal to 1. Now, but as I told in the beginning, this is more or less trivial because we are in 1 plus 1 dimension, so we knew that the momenta would be conserved. So this would be true for more or less any theory. I would just scatter, I would obtain a different S matrix, but the two-body problem is always more or less solvable, and this is always more or less a solution with some different S matrix. So when it starts being untrivial, when I consider three magnets. I will not do it in detail, I will just write the result. So let's now consider three magnets, and let me introduce the following notation. I have P, I, J, K, which is given by the exponential of I times K, I, N1 plus K, J, N2 plus kk n3. I have this wave function where the momenta are permuted in this way. And I also introduce sij, which is just s matrix of pi, of ki. I'm using k for momenta with kj. Then my wave function of n1, n2, and n3 is given by six terms, phi 1, 2, 3. This is just the identity, no particles are exchanged. Plus phi 2, 1, 3 times S 1, 2. This, as this is the graphical interpretation, two particles might scatter. Plus phi 1, 3, 2 times S 2, 3. This time the two last particles scattered. Plus phi 3, 1, 2 S 1, 3. S23, this diagram I can think as this one, plus phi 231 S13 S12, this one similar, plus the most complicated one, 321 S23 S13 S12, where I have a diagram like this. So you see that all these terms, they can be interpreted as some scattering process. And what is very non-trivial about this wave function, and this is the bit on that, is that these S matrices which appear here are precisely this S matrix here. So the two of the S matrix is the only thing which enters in writing this on that. And the momenta here are just permuted. They have just some IJK, which I sometimes permute. And next, I impose periodicity of the wave function. And periodicity of the wave function now gives me, it's even written here, gives me precisely this equation. Now, periodicity of the wave function gives me exponential, I will just copy it, is equal to the product k not equal to j up to n. I've made the product to the other side, so I will put 1 over the S matrix of Pj Pk. So these are bit equations. N, in this case, is equal to 3. And this can be seen that it holds in general. For N magnets, this is the form of the wave function. So you might ask, why? So you might ask, where is this extra charge, Q3? Why did we got this miracle that the scattering factorized? Why was the ansatz so simple? Why this equation, why in the XXX spin chain, when the three are together, why the momenta is not, is only permuted? Where is this Q3? Any question otherwise?
So it's so, sorry, can I just backtrack a bit? So
yeah.
It's the statement that by doing this ansatz, you can find all the eigenstates, but not just some of them. So you really find all of them.
Sorry? Here I find, I compute the energy, and the energy I get from sum then of epsilon.
Right. So I'm just saying that if I, so for example, take three particles, and then there are presumably a lot of energy eigenstates. So it's a very big space, and there are so many energy eigenstates. And the statement is that by doing this ansatz, I really find all.
All states are of this form. So in general, for some theory, you expect some exponential of I k1 n1 plus I k2 n2 plus I k3 n3 plus some integral where energy and p is conserved, right? Of exponential of I k prime 1 n1 I k prime 3 n3, some wave function k which depends on k1 prime k3 prime, right? So in general, you have a combination. Energy and momentum is conserved, but not the individual ones. But here, really, all the individual are conserved, and you just have these wave functions permuting them.
I guess I'm just trying to say that I'm supposed to have a very long chain, and I have so many particles on the chain.
Huh?
It's a quite complicated counting problem to really count how many eigenstates you
exactly.
find by
yes.
using this ansatz.
Yes, so here it's possible to count them.
So you're saying get to the
here you can count the states of the spin chain by means of bit ansatz. I might explain a bit later, even today, how to count them. You can count the states which come from these equations and say that they give precisely all the full spectrum of the Eisenberg chain.
Okay, thanks.
Before doing that, notice, oh, you don't notice anymore. Ah, you know, the S matrix has this form, so this S matrix is screaming for us to redefine K as one half of cotangent of K over 2. Right, one half of cotangent appears everywhere in the S matrix. This definition implies that U plus I over 2 over U minus I over 2 this is just exponential of I times momenta. And therefore, this bit and that equation, they can be written in a nice form, which is the polynomial form. I have uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2 to the L. This is the momenta. It's equal to the product of k not equal to j, uj minus uk plus I over uj minus uk minus I. So bit equation in this form, this rational form I have, so bit equation are just some polynomial equations in U which I must solve. And I have this epsilon, now written as function of U, is just 1 over U squared plus 1 quarter. So I find this U and I sum 1 over uj squared plus 1 quarter. This you might have seen, this is the form where as bit equations are normally written. This is what we put in a computer once we want to numerically solve them. So let me just mention, maybe I will skip the part of where is Q3 because I want to explain this term model. I want not to put this model in finite temperature. Then I will come back to the point and explain why this model is simple. So where is Q3? I will maybe at the end. Otherwise, I might not have time. So now I will put this model at finite temperature. So we are considering now a condensed matter problem. We have a spin chain, we put it in finite temperature, and now we want to compute the free energy of this model. So, let me anticipate, because otherwise it might seem like a crazy exercise. The reason why I'm going to do this exercise is because, as I will explain in the last lecture, the solution to the spectra of n equals 4 in finite volume is related to a trick of looking at the theory, which is defined in a finite circle, times time, is related to the problem where we will weak rotate the theory and think of it as an infinite line times some finite temperature. So technically, what we will end up doing will be very similar to considering spin chains at finite temperature, although not exactly the same. But technically, it is very similar, and therefore, it's useful to consider this one. So I want to consider x at some finite, temperature. So to compute the free energy, I want to compute the free energy, which will be some beta energy minus the entropy. So as you said, to understand the entropy, I need to understand how to count the states, how to organize my states. I need to understand how to organize them to be able to write what is the entropy, what is an entropy in this beta and that. So these guys here, they have many solutions. How can I write an entropy for all these solutions? How can I compute the free energy? So to compute this free energy, so we need to understand we need to understand the pattern of the solutions uj. So we need to understand how these uj is organized. Are they real? Are they complex? What are the solutions to these equations? So to speak about this, I will speak about strings. Nothing to do with the usual strings, but strings in condensed matter.
So when you say solutions, you mean including complex solutions?
Including complex solutions. I need to sum over all states. So what would be complex solutions? So complex solutions, when I have some complex momenta.
Do you suppose that the total momentum is real?
Yes. I suppose. So what does it mean to have complex momenta? Complex momenta, when I look at my wave functions, means that my wave functions are localized when, say, n1 is close to n2, and then it decays when n1 is separated apart from n2. So when I'm speaking about the possibility of having complex momenta, the picture I have in mind is whether there exists states where I have some spin down going with some momentum, but I might also have some localized state where I have like three particles, for example, going together, some bound states. Of three spins going up. So this will be some bound state. And I want to understand, do they exist, such bound states, or not? As my theory, some bound states. So to consider some complex momenta, we say that let uj be equal to some u plus some complex quantity eta, and let the real part of eta, eta is already a real number, let eta be bigger than z. So let's consider u to be slightly complex. Notice that when u is real, u real corresponds to p real. When u is real, this is a pure phase because it's something over complex conjugate. Right? So when u is real, this is real. So u real is p real. Now I consider u to be slightly complex, it will mean that p is slightly complex. So if eta is positive, then let me call this equation beta and Zant equation. So if eta is positive, then the left hand side of the beta and Zant equation goes to infinity. I'm considering the thermodynamic limit where L is very large. So it goes to infinity. If I pick here some real number, as I told you, this is just a phase. But if this number has a positive imaginary part, because of this exponent, this L here, it explodes, diverges exponentially in L. So it goes to infinity. So therefore, we must have a root uk. There must be a root uk such that this right hand side also explodes. In other words, the S matrix must have a pole. This is the usual argument, as poles of S matrix give bound states. There must exist a uk such that uj minus uk minus I is equal to zero. So there must be a uk which is close to u, separated by uj plus I. Then, therefore, the picture we have, I will now immediately give the full answer, is that in a complex plane, I have real solutions. Then I have solutions separated by I, made of two strings. Or I can have solutions with three strings, also separated by I, or more strings. So this one here, for example, with three strings, would be this one here. Okay, so I can have complex solutions provided they are separated by I. So this gives me my spectrum. This is the spectrum of the real solutions and some complex solutions with some magnets n. In this case, n is equal to 3. Okay. So what are these solutions when n is equal to 3? The center of this U. So U is the center of the three string. In this case. So what is the momenta of this n string as function of its center? So to find the momenta of the string, as you said, I sum over the momenta of the constitutional of the magnets which constitute this guy. The total momentum will be real, even though the constituent will not be real. So I sum over the momenta, which means that I multiply these terms. When I multiply these terms, when u's are in a string, most terms cancel because I have plus I over 2 minus I over 2. Unless the first one and the last one. So I get that the momenta is simply u plus I n over 2 over u minus I n over 2. This is the momenta now for the magnet of size n. Then we can write the beta and Zant equations, the fused beta and Zant equations, which already govern the centers of these complexes, only the centers of the strings. Now they only deal again with real numbers. So it will be of the form I will have some uj plus I n over 2 over uj minus I n over 2 to the L. And this will be equal to a product. Now uj also has an index n, because now there are positions of several sides, a product over k and m of some S matrix n and m between ujn and ukm, the centers of the thing. And this S matrix is found as I found this by multiplying the constituents. I have two strings and I have another string here. To find this S matrix, I consider the scattering of each guy with all the other ones. So this gives me an S matrix. I have an effective S matrix between the centers of the two strings. So this will be the S matrix between the center U and the center of the string V. Real. So this is a good description. Now I know that my particles, they are strings with some real center and they can have some size. So this is important for the thermodynamic description of the two. So any question here? So this describes how the spectrum of the XXXT chain organizes in the complex plane. There are strings, And the final bit, the scheduling between strings is obtained by.
Can you read the last equation? What is it?
SNM. So it's an S matrix of between a string of size n and a string of size m. And then the arguments, since I multiply the scattering between, only depends now on the center, which I call ujn and ukm.
And it's obtained just by multiplying n copies of.
And it's obtained by picking this fundamental S matrix, which is the scattering between the two u's, and multiplying this over all these possible lines here.
So what is uj and uk? How are they defined?
Uj and uk are the centers of this string.
Because you have two.
I have two strings, so one string has ujn, which is, no, I one string is uj. The sets of u's in one string are ujn plus ia, where a is, goes from minus n minus 1 over 2 over n minus 1 over 2. See, you have a string with some center, and then.
Let's say that n is even. Then what is the center?
N is even. So I have here, yeah. Here, and here. Center is this.
But it's not a.
It's not a root. So the position of the real part of the position of this root.
So uj is not a root in this case.
No, it's the center of the string. This ujn, I already multiplied this. So I obtain an equation only for the centers, for these centers here. They might be roots or they might not be roots. So I have a string of size n. There is this pattern. And of course, since this is the only thing which will enter at the end, the center of the string. The individual ones, by construction, they disappear. Okay, so this is something it was important to do before we could address the question of computing the free energy, because we needed to understand how the states were organized. Let me say that it's a nice exercise for the, if you consider in n equals 4, if we consider operators of the form similar to these ones, but with a covariant derivative instead of an X field, this is what is called the SL2 sector. The big equations are exactly the same, except of a minus here and a plus here. And you can do the exercise that all solutions are real. There are no strings. OK. I don't know why I put an exclamation mark. That's not this question. But OK. So the next thing I would want to introduce in this Wittgenstein's technology is the notion of particles and holes. It's again a known concept in condensed matter. So,
can I ask a question here?
Sure.
Which probably is really stupid, but
questions are welcome.
I mean, if I really think about those down states, say, and if I really want to think about those and roots. To group into a string as some sort of, say, meson of n particles, then there seems to be a sense in which I should have a ground state for those, say, mesons, but then I can also try to excite them. There should be some exciting states for them. Is there a similar notion for that here? I mean, so here, what you seem to be saying so is that if I really say consider a m particle bound state, there is precisely, say modulo the center of mass degrees freedom, there is say precisely just one state for that bound state.
Yes.
Is that what you are saying, basically?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to understand. Thanks.
They are separate. You mean, once you tell me that the bound state is made of n particles, the only way that they can arrange themselves in a bound state is in this vertical thing of n side.
Right. I see. Okay.
That's the only way. Okay. When L goes to infinity. Because of what I said, they really must be separated by I, so the only complex objects are these things.
Okay, thank you.
And as you said, if you consider this picture as being some kind of pattern, this is precisely what you would think of, that each quark interacts with the other quarks, and you get the final S matrix between the partons by combining all the interactions.
Can you show the counting now? To show that they are complete?
Sorry? Can you show the counting of the states?
I mean, the counting involves, I will tell what's the idea. Mm-hmm. Okay? Excuse so,
can we still close on this line in the new plane? But if you go back to position space along the.
So they are closed in position space because this use being complex means that the P is complex. Mm-hmm. So it means that in this wave functions, two moments are complex, and therefore, if two moments are complex, right, two are complex only. So it means that there are two n's, n1 and n2, say, which have these two complex momenta. And those two, the real part is the center of mass, and the imaginary part is opposite. It means that it decays when n1 is separated from n2. If you have a three particle bound state, similarly, you have a center of mass, and then it decays when the three particles are separated. So they are really bound states, physical ones. I would see them in X space. So now I want to introduce the notion of particles and holes, and this is related to the counting particles and holes. So in Wittansatz, I have the following equation. Let me take the log of Wittansatz equation and write them in the following form. Pj times L plus some sum over K of some phase shift of Pj and Pk is equal. So I took the log of bit equations. And notice that this is equal to this means that the log is equal to the log plus 2 pi n in general. In general, when I take the log, I can have here plus 2 pi nj. Right? So in general, when I take the log, the exponential of this is times I is 1 means that the phase will be 2 pi n I. So this is the way to count the states. When you look at this polynomial, it's very hard to tell how many solutions there are. So in general, if I have here a polynomial of degree L plus N, it's very hard to tell how many solutions there are to this polynomial of many variables. Now, in this way, it's possible to show, because it's possible to show that these equations come from a functional which is convex, it's possible to show that for one choice of N, there is only one choice of P. So the solutions, they are parametrized by the sets of n's which I choose. So I choose one n for each particle, and this gives me one solution, which is natural. Like in free particle case, I have exponential of e times p times l is equal to 1, and the set and moment is 2 pi n over l. The n parametrizes me the several solutions. So here it's exactly the analog of p is equal to 2 pi n over l, except that there is this matrix. And I smoothly deform, and I get only one solution for each choice of n's. And now, what I can see is that this momenta here, when I take the log, if I would take the log, now I will answer the question about counting, I will only explain by word. This is some arctangent when I take the log. This is also some arctangent. So it is bounded to go from minus pi to pi. Therefore, these integers are bounded. So then I should also consider, I should rather consider these equations already perfused, and the bounds on the choice of n's will depend on which type of a string I'm considering. So I will have, when I will take the log, I will see that my n, j, for a given size m, so this is size of string, in this discussion here I'm omitting for now that there are several types of strings, will be bounded between some n which will depend on n and some minus n which will depend on m. Okay? And then by doing the combinatorics, now you understand the idea, I do the combinatorics and I get that the number is equal to 2 to the n, as I should get. But here I'm omitting several steps on how to count, but now it's a combinatoric problem. Okay? Back to here. So I have this problem here. So each n gives me some set. So as I said, I can choose my nj's. If I have some n particles, I can choose them to be something. I pick this n, I can pick n equal 1, 2, imagine 3, I don't pick, I pick n equal 4, I pick n equal 5, I don't pick this one, I pick this one. So I choose some sets of n's and I get some solution. And now there is a very important notion of counting function, which is the following. Let me define a function of p which is given by a sum . So it depends on the positions pk, but now this p, it's a function of p. This is by definition my function 2 pi n of p. or n of u, if I parameterize this in terms of u. It's a function n of u. Or n of u, of course, if I write this. Let me take it as of n of u. So what is this function? This function is a form. It's a function, n of u, as function of u. And this function looks something like this. And what happens when I start moving u? Whenever I find a particle, whenever I find a position of beta roots, this n is equal to nj. So whenever I find some root u1, I get the corresponding n1. And I find the root u2, and I get the other n2. And in this way, I get these n's which I chose here. This one was 1, this one was 1. At some point, there are some n which I did not choose, which will correspond to some value, which I can call u whole 1, which is not a solution of bit equations. And then I continue, and I get my particle, which is u3, which corresponds to this n equals this n3 here. And here, this is this n whole. So this function, what happens is that I want some particles, some holes. And here I have some particles and some holes. So this would be a hole, this would be a hole also.
This so one. Hole is the value of u which does not correspond to n which you chose.
Exactly. So u, hole is a value of u for which this is also an integer, but not one in my original list. So it does not obey bit equations. Bit equations, it's only when I have a p which enters here. So I have this particle and holes. And then, if I, with this definition, it's natural to have dn du with some 1 over n, then this will be given. When I change a bit, I get particles, but I also get holes. So I get rho plus rho holes. Because when I change a bit n here, I get here particles and holes. I don't get only particles. This function n that is not counts both particles and holes. And therefore, in the continuum limit, bit equations look as follows. I have, I take log in the continuum limit, the derivative ddu of the log of the bit of that equation. I can write them in the continuum limit in this form. I have rho plus rho holes. Okay. Rho holes, let me put rho holes, let me define it as rho bar. I have rho plus rho bar. It's equal to sum, so the derivative of momenta, p prime of u, because I took the derivative, plus this delta of u and u prime convoluted with density rho. So I get an equation on rho and rho bar, which is of this form. So the sum here, I transform it into an integral, and of course only density of particles appears. But the n, when I take the derivative, I get both rho and rho plus. So this is bit, these are bit equations in the continuum. Any questions? These are how to describe bit equations. Now a huge circle with lots of particles there. Let me be more precise. With strings, if I have strings, then I should put an index n here, an index n here. Momenta will depend on n, as I wrote there, and then this scattering, I have scattering between n and m, and I have m. I should sum over m from 1 to infinity. So with strings, the several strings can scatter, and I should sum between the scattering of m and m. So I have delta between n and m. Right? Some question? Something you know?
So rho and rho bar are functions of u, right?
Rho and rho bar are functions of u.
P prime of u.
P prime of u, P of u is given by this expression. Pn of u is given by this expression. So P prime of u is the derivative of this here.
And you have the delta of u from u prime?
Sorry, this delta is the delta which appears here.
Yes.
So delta n m is equal to 1 over 2 pi I derivative with respect to u of the log of the S matrix n and m. A view.
And then you're convoluting, so the convolution
is here it's u minus u prime plus integral rho n of u prime du prime. This is what I mean. Delta is a bad name. Delta looks like a delta function. It is logarithm. It is the notation normally for phase shift. Okay, so we understood how to write. We understood what are strings. Strings are bound states which appear in bit and zats. And I explained how to write bit equation in a continuum limit using this notion of particles and holes. I should tell that it is possible to trace the description of the system of, in terms of particles by the description of the dynamics of holes. This is what's called in finite matter particle hole transformation. But I will not. I might mention that at the last course, but for now I will not. So I have this equation. And now I can compute, I will try now to compute the free energy. Okay? So what is the free energy? Let me write one more thing before we go. Epsilon n of u, which was this energy, if you sum the energy of a string, it's easy to see that it's given by n over u squared plus n squared over 2. And you can notice that this is also the same as the derivative of u. So this is just obtained by summing 1 over u squared plus 1 quarter. Sorry. For when n is 1, you get what I told, 1 over u squared plus 1 quarter. When n is 2, 3, this is what you get for the energy of the string of size n.
The notion of particle and null relates to the excitation about the vacuum when you fit the size of the
material? Yes, it relates to that. So when you have some antiferromagnetic, when you have lots of particle excited, then almost all n are excited, say in the antiferromagnetic vacuum, then what's natural to consider as excitations are holes rather than magnets. These holes, they are normally called spinons in condensed matter. So the spinons are the excitations above antiferromagnetic, and magnets are the excitations above the ferromagnetic. And they are precisely these holes and particles. So this is what we know. So what is the free energy then in this description? The free energy is given by an integral over u, and then there is beta times the energy. So beta times energy of u times rho n of u, and there is here a sum over n. This gives me the term for the energy. I sum over the energy of my strings. And then there is the entropy. And the entropy, this term will come from expanding the ways of choosing now these integers n to choose who is holes and who are particles. So this will be a Stirling expansion of rho plus rho holes du factorial over rho du factorial rho bar du factorial. And if you expand this, so this is the way to put these holes and particles. So you see how important it was to organize my states into strings. Otherwise, I would never be able to count what are the solutions of this way. Now I have this very nice way of counting how many states there are. It's just these ways of distributing these several n's. And then I have this expansion of this term gives me rho n log of 1 plus rho n bar over rho n plus rho n bar log 1 plus rho n over rho n bar. Okay, so we wrote the free energy of the XXX spin shape. So this is a well-defined problem. And as I explained it, technically it will be related to n plus 4. So we have this, and now we want to compute what is the free energy. This is the free energy per unit length. There is an L here, and the densities, they are defined with this one breath. So this is the free energy per unit length. Now, since L is very big, here I can do a saddle point approximation to compute this free energy. So I should minimize and compute that by saddle points. So I should make a saddle point to compute this free energy, the usual statistical mechanism. So I should do a saddle point. So I should compute delta F equals 0. And then I should compute what is the free energy at the extremum.
If you write these terms as log n plus 1 bar times log 1 plus 1 bar minus 1 over more intuitive, the notion of entropy.
This one's? Now, this is normally what you get when you consider some gas of particles. If you consider the problem of putting particles in box and you do Stirling, it's normally split this. You can think of this NA, NB over NA. This is the entropy that you get when you, right? I mean, I'm just expanding in Stirling binomial coefficients. You get always this kind of stuff. Yes? No?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I get this entropy here. And now I want to compute what is the free energy at the extremum. And then I can take derivative with respect to beta to compute specific heat. Then I can do whatever I want and get some physical quantity that I can measure. So when we compute delta F equals zero, we should remember that rho and rho bar, they are not independent, but they obey this constraint. So when I compute this, I should keep that in mind that delta rho bar n is equal to minus delta rho n, I'm varying these big equations, plus delta n m convoluted with delta rho n. So I vary this using, for delta rho bar, using this expression, and then I can write this variation as an integral of delta rho n of u times beta p prime n of u minus log rho n over rho n bar minus k m n delta n m convoluted with log 1 plus rho m over rho m bar. Okay, let me see if I did not mistake of signs. But this is what I get. I get delta rho times something, which I will impose to be zero. Rho n and bar, the opposite sign for this is okay. And when I put it in the same sign, I get the same. Come on. Good. Okay. So this, when I impose that this is equal to zero, I get the condition for the extrema. I should impose that this equation is satisfied. And notice here that what this equation, when I vary, this is just a question of varying and replacing rho bar plus this. Notice that what enters in this equation is only this ratio, rho n over rho n bar. Rho n and rho, it appear only through this ratio. Okay? This ratio, rather the inverse of this ratio, rho n bar over rho n, this is what is called the Weiss, which will constitute the Weiss system. So the Weiss that we derived in our recent paper, which described the n equals 4 spectrum, in their derivation, their origin was they described some ratios of densities of holes over densities of particles of some strings of n equals 4. So these are defined, I define them as Weiss. Okay? And then my equation then what I get is simply that log of yn is equal to beta p prime n plus k m n convoluted with log of 1 plus 1 over yn. Okay. So these are the TBA equations, thermodynamic Beta-Salt equations. And once these equations are satisfied, it's easy to see that down the free energy is simply given by minus integral of p prime n of u log of 1 plus 1 over yn and also a sum over n. So this is the solution to what we wanted. So we have here the thermodynamics for the XXX spin shape. So everything is solved. Here is the free energy. I just solved the first equation, plug the Y's into the second, and I get the free energy, which is, of course, a function of beta. And I can compute the specific heat, etc. And this is even a model which can be realized in nature. The one dimension, it's actually some sheets of material, and the one dimension is the dimension perpendicular to the sheets of material, and so it's really something that one can relate very easily to some physical quantities. Now, to end, I would just like to finish by saying what is the Weiss system, because this is something that you might have seen. So, Weiss system is just these TVA equations written in a slightly different form. The idea is the following. I define some f plus minus as being some function of u plus minus I over 2 minus plus I0. So I define this quantity here. And then I consider the quantity log of yn plus yn minus over yn plus 1 over in minus 1. What you see, so this, you see, it's like a discrete Laplacian. If I split this log into log of 1 plus another minus the other minus the other, with these sheets of I and n of this argument and also with the index n, it's almost like a discrete Laplacian, right? When I apply this to these terms here, recall that both these p's and these deltas, they were obtained by fusion. They were obtained themselves by summing lots of terms shifted by I over 2. So what happened when I apply this combination is that all these terms almost die. If I say that this is Laplacian applied to log of yn, then I can use the following identities. Laplacian applied to p prime of n is delta function of n and 1 times delta function of u. Now this is really delta function. And Laplacian applied to this kernel, this is an exercise one can easily do, is just delta n plus 1 plus delta n m minus 1. Okay? This is something you can just plug the expressions, apply this operation to p prime and to delta, and you get these delta functions. So what happens is that this term here, where there was the sum here, of course, n equal 1 to infinity, all strings interact with all strings. When I construct these quantities using these delta functions, I collapse it. I get beta delta n1 times delta u plus then some log 1 plus 1 over yn plus 1, 1 plus 1 over yn minus 1. So I got this nice equation. Now it's a set of functional equations where the index n only interacts with the neighbors n plus 1 and n minus 1. So these equations, and I will finish here, I can write them. These equations, I can then write them as yn plus yn minus is equal to 1 plus yn plus 1, 1 plus yn minus 1, e to the minus beta. When n is equal to 1, there is an extra source term with a Kronecker delta. And f plus minus, as I wrote there, is f of u plus minus I over 2. So this equation I can represent graphically as saying that I have my index n, which runs from 1 to infinity. And then at the last node, I have some contact interaction delta. So this is the picture. From this picture, you can immediately guess the equation. You can read the equation. And this is what is called the Y system. It's a set of functional equations which are represented by such diagrams. So what is, any question here? So what I told is you solve these functional equations, which are represented by this picture, and you can compute the free energy of the XXX spin chain in terms of this YX.
Can you explain the picture again?
The picture means that the index n here interacts with the index n plus 1 and n minus 1. I have this term here. There's n plus 1 and n minus 1. I can think of this term as 1, if you want, plus ym to the power of some incidence matrix, imn, and I make product over all m. And this incidence matrix is 1 when they are neighbors and 0 otherwise. And this incidence matrix telling who is connected to who is what this picture is. Right? It tells me that the index n connects with n plus 1 and the n minus 1. This is what appears here. N appears connected to n plus 1 and n minus 1.
So you have other system with more complicated picture like that.
Exactly. So for example, this was the XXX spin chain, the SU2 spin chain. And now if you would consider some more complicated systems, like the SU3 spin chain, for example, SU3 spin chain has a Dynkin diagram, which is like this. And And the picture that you will get now is that this linking diagram will grow, like each of the SU2s inside SU3 will have its own bound states, and they will also be coupled like this. So immediately, so this will be, and there will be a contact interaction here again. Actually, there will be two here and here. So this picture immediately gets the SU3, and you can of course get the SUN. And by these terms now, I mean that here I would have some interaction, which would be Y. I will have now an F AS plus times Y AS minus is equal to 1 plus Y A prime S prime to the power of some incidence matrix between A and S and A prime S prime. And this incidence matrix, if the line is like this, gives me like 1. If the line is like this, it's a subtlety. It's just a point between minus 1. Otherwise, it gives 0. They are not connected. So it just connects this node and this node. Yeah?
In terms of the intuition on this YNS and this prime, the bound states of n, alpha, and all that annihilate 1 and bound state of n minus 1 particles n.
So these indices here now, in the same way that here they were, this was just a single particle. This came from a string of 2 particles. This from a string of 3 particles. What will happen here is that you will have now bound states associated with which each one of the SU2s.
I'm still talking about the
Are you still thinking about this?
I'm talking about the equation.
This one?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Intuition of the YN interact on the YN plus 1 and YN minus 1.
Yes. You are saying, could it, if I can think of it as saying that you can precise it. So this plus and minus is like shifting a bit the string by plus minus I over 2. So it is indeed natural to say that this object, I mean, of course, this is only unwaving because the exact statement is the derivation. But unwaving, I can say that the object which is related to this string by this shift of plus minus I over 2, it's an object which is slightly bigger, which is the string which is plus I, when the shifts are up and down, or and an object which is slightly smaller. So there is indeed this notion that moving the string and this connects to the two neighboring strings of size plus and minus 1.
So
in SU, yeah.
Sorry, but this is probably a free association, but suppose I do not have any, suppose I do not have any interaction, but I just consider the combinatorial problem where three particles of arbitrary sizes of bound space, but fixing the total number of particles, and then to consider the thermodynamic problem, the thermodynamic problem of that problem.
So I can put the chemical potential. So what it will amount to putting some chemical potential here,
right?
In the free energy here, I could put here some mu n rho n, and then at the end take the Legendre transform.
I'm just trying to say that if I consider that problem, I probably can also derive a Y system where Y tells me basically how many particles of each size there should be in the thermodynamic limit.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just trying to build some intuition about what would be the form of the Y equation in the end look like. Will that also take a form, so roughly of that form, or that's
that would be an extra term here. Related to the YNs, but something I don't remember exactly.
I'm not sure I'm talking about something.
Sorry?
I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing, but we'll probably talk about it later.
Okay. Okay, so I think I'll finish here. So the what I want to transmit is that these Y systems, they encode the symmetry group of the problem which I'm considering, in this case SU3, in this case SU2, and typically I get some set of functional equations of this form where I have some discrete Laplacian being equal to this 1 plus Y in some incidence in some lattice which encodes the structure of whole bound states of the theory. So okay, let me just make a summary of what we did. So we start by n equals 4, we computed the dilatation operator of n equals 4, and I told you that this Hamiltonian was integrable. And this was related to two particular terms in the Hamiltonian which made it integrable. One can do the exercise, for example, of checking that the three body S matrix only factorizes if they have this relative coefficient. Then I consider this subsector, this SO2 subsector, and where particles basically have no degrees of freedom. Particles are just spinned up, and vacuum is just spin up. So then the S matrix is not a matrix, it's just a phase, and Bt equations take just a simple form, exponential of P is equal to the product of the phases, the product of the phase shifts, sum of phase shifts. This gives me the exact spectrum of the SO2 spin chain, and one can understand that the objects which appear in this spin chain are particles and bound states of particles, which are called strings. And using this knowledge, one can compute the free energy of the XXX chain. We obtain a set of Y systems, which is typical of condensed matter for all models. Thermodynamics, the thermodynamics, the final equations are always of this form, I can tell. And I told you that for more complicated systems of higher, based on a higher rank group, the Y systems are still of the same form, but they will live on a more complicated lattice. So tomorrow I will speak about the generalization of this picture of SU2 to the general picture. I will not speak about Y systems, this I will speak only at the very end. I will speak mostly about how to go beyond one loop and now consider all loops but still in the asymptotic region. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so my next lecture will be